Hi, and welcome to the Kubernetes podcast from Google. I'm Craig Box with my very special guest host, Patrick Flynn. It was 3 years ago that this very podcast first launched at KubeCon Europe in Copenhagen. You were there, Patrick. What do you remember from that event?
Oh, KubeCon in Copenhagen. That was fun. I think the most notable thing I remember is getting on the plane to go home and look in my bag and realizing I'd lost my Nintendo Switch. That was pretty brutal. I had like my save game for Zelda, and it was before the cloud save. It was pretty traumatic, actually.
Any positive experiences from the time in Copenhagen, or is it just the loss of the Switch?
No, I think the other thing that I remember really well is that I think it's when I first met the Jameses. So James Rowling and James Strachan, I don't know if you know them, but they were of Jenkins X fame.
Yes, and they would have been maybe of Fabricate at the time?
Yeah, that's right. They were working on Fabricate at the time. And I was working on Java tools, so we were just starting the JIP project. And Dan Lawrence was there, who's sort of famous now for Tecton and his open source security toolchain work. But I think that was the beginning of the conversations around Tecton and that Jenkins X eventually adopted.
It's amazing what happens at all of these in-person events. And it's kind of a shame to think, well, seeing as we haven't been able to meet up in hallways and just have these conversations, that we may find that we're a little bit behind in some of the serendipitous things that could come out of them. But we perhaps with a bit more thoughtful planning, we'll still be able to have some cool stuff come out for the next couple of years until we're able to reprime the pump, as it were, with meetings.
Yeah, I hear you. I really hope that we can be back in a conference setting pretty soon.
Now, just as things started to close down around the world, I understand that you packed up and moved to Canada, but not for the reasons others may have.
Yeah, I actually had the plan set up before COVID, and then COVID hit just as I was kind of pushing the button. So that was pretty difficult. I have three children. We were moving out of New York to Montreal during the quarantine. Yeah, it was a tough choice, but I was really excited by the project. I'm now working on reCAPTCHA. Actually, the product has been around for a long time, but we've just started realizing how valuable it is to enterprise and the fact that we had a big gap in terms of the enterprise offering. So I've been leading that effort.
Is there any truth to the rumor that the fact that we're all now asked to identify what traffic lights look like is something to do with self-driving cars?
It's completely false. In fact, it used to be the case that the reCAPTCHA challenges were used to derive value for the geo organization and their, you know, machine learning algorithms. Mm-hmm. But that's no longer the case. Google doesn't really get anything out of those challenges. In fact, we have a new version of the product that doesn't include challenges at all, and we encourage our customers to move away from them.
So we're no longer having to decipher scrawly text. Does that mean we've solved the problem of scanning books?
Well, I think we just don't do that anymore.
The robots have got too good at scanning books.
Yeah.
One thing that I remember about my time in Canada is a subtle difference on the topic of traffic lights, is that where I had grown up in New Zealand and here in the UK as well, the traffic light is normally at the front of the intersection. So you drive up to the line where the first traffic light is, and then you stop. And in Canada, they hang them up in these larger intersections, but the traffic light you're looking at is actually at the back of the intersection. So you have the whole box of the intersection and the traffic lights hanging on the other side of it. And I do remember late at night, one night, thinking, oh, I've driven straight through the intersection because I'm driving up to try and stop at this red light, but it's not where I expect it to be.
Yeah, I've noticed that as well. It seems like an accident waiting to happen. Fortunately, I haven't had a car, so I haven't had to worry too much about it.
No, unfortunately, by that point, I was well aware of which side of the road I was meant to be driving on, so I didn't have too much trouble there.
Yeah, that's the extra challenge for people coming from the UK.
Well, it's going to be a busy couple of weeks in terms of news. There have been a bunch of pre-KubeCon announcements that we'll cover today, and there'll be a whole lot more in next week's KubeCon roundup. So without further ado, let's get to the news. Microsoft has acquired the cloud-native company Kinvolk. Kinvolk started as a consultancy in Germany and has built products including Flatcar Linux, a drop-in replacement for CoreOS Container Linux. Microsoft's announcement calls out their intention to continue to support Flatcar, as well as Kinvolk's other upstream contributions, while the team will become part of the Azure Engineering Org. We talked to Kinvolk's CEO in episode 79.
Red Hat's virtual summit recently concluded, and they're very keen to let you know they're not just an OS company anymore. Announcements include a new version of OpenShift Container Platform called Platform Plus, which drops new episodes Fridays at midnight. Other OpenShift cloud services are in the areas of API management, Apache Kafka, and data sciences. And a new version of Enterprise Linux was also launched to remind you they're still a little bit an OS company.
Hosting vendor Rackspace has announced a strategic investment in Platform 9, and using their technology has launched Rackspace Managed Platform for Kubernetes. MPK is a Kubernetes as a service backed by Platform 9's PMK, an easy shuffle of letters, and Rackspace's trademark fanaticism. Learn more about Platform 9 in episode 88.
Kubernetes IDE, Lens, is going multi-user in the new version 5 beta. Lens Spaces is a cloud service which lets you define a set of clusters relating to a team and grant access to multiple users. You can also proxy connections to them through a Cluster Connect service, giving you a one-click access with no VPNs required. No word yet on if Spaces will be a paid feature when it leaves beta, but they did call out that Lens will continue to work as a single-user service.
Another week, another enterprise data protection vendor gets on the Kubernetes train. Last week it was Zerto, and this week it's HYCU, or Haiku, bringing out Haiku Protégé. The service will back up your YAML and your disks both, and is GA for GKE, with other services to follow soon.
This week's billion-dollar security vendor is Sysdig, raising a $189 million Series F at a $1.19 billion valuation. Sysdig's commercial platform is built on their open source projects like Falco, which we learned about in episode 91. The round was led by Third Point Ventures and PremG Invest.
Two new GKE features have been launched to preview. Multiple instance GPUs let you partition your NVIDIA A100 GPU into 7 instances, which you can share between different containers for better utilization. You can attach up to 16 GPUs to a GCE virtual machine, which lets you have a whopping 112 individual schedulable GPUs with which to render your Blender. The GKE Gateway Controller lets you use the new Kubernetes Gateway API to define role-oriented traffic routing rules in an evolution of the ingress concept. There are gateway classes for regional internal and global external load balances, and with multi-cluster gateways using the GKE Hub, you can easily run services in multiple clusters worldwide.
Finally, if you've been having trouble keeping up with the unrelenting pace of listening to 4 release team lead interviews every year, you can rest up. The Kubernetes community has officially moved to a 3 releases per year model, permanently adopting the plan that was first thrust upon us by the year 2020.
And that's the news. Alex Palisandro is a research assistant at Politecnico di Torino in Italy and co-creator of the LICO project. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
You studied at the Polytechnic of Turin before coming back and working there where you are now. Did your relationship with the professors change from when you were a student and now you're working there as staff?
Yeah, it's changed quite a bit because when you are on the other side, you see the university life as completely different. So, for example, you understand how much work has to be done in order to provide courses and labs and how many hours are spent. So it was really interesting and it made me think about when I was a student, I was always saying, no, but this course is not that good. Now there is always a lot of work behind it. And it changed the way I think about the work of people that create courses.
You did your bachelor's and master's in Turin, but your PhD was from University Jean Moulin in Lyon in France. What language did you do it in?
Mainly in French. Mm-hmm. After the first year of master, I decided to apply for a double degree program with the University of Grenoble, and that made me to go to France. Mm-hmm. I finished my degree there, and then I moved for an internship to Paris, where I also started my PhD. So my PhD was sponsored by a company with the University of Jean Lyon. So it was mainly in French. It was a bit hard because you have not only to speak French, but also to know the technical vocabulary in French, which is really different from the English words. But yeah, at the end, it was also fun. So.
You obviously speak at least 2 more languages than I do. What order did you learn the languages in?
I think in France, they are really kind and help you if you try to express yourself in French. So it's nice to try and they are not laughing at you if you misspell a word or do the R the wrong way. As Italian, we do a lot this kind of mistake. I learned also French. I work in a company speaking French all the time and it was fine. So,
had you learned French before that or did you learn it at school?
I had some French course at the high school, but I was not that confident. And when I moved to France, I had to really put my head on the books and to understand a bit more the verbs and so on.
What was the work you were doing in your internship in Paris?
Yeah, so I worked on the nested virtualization. So it was this idea of putting multiple layer of hypervisors in order to enforce more security on cloud infrastructure. So at the time, there was a lot of interest in hypervisors and how hypervisors were designed in order to minimize the trusted computing base. So the idea was to have one really tiny hypervisor on the lowest layer and then another commodity hypervisor that was the privilege somehow, and so it cannot harm the system and it can be controlled by the other hypervisor, which is more privileged. So this was the work. The main problem of that were the performance. So these multiple layers of virtualization were not really supported by the hardware at the time. I don't know now. And so the performance were not that good as you have with a single layer of virtualization.
How many layers of virtualization can we do now? Can we go full inception and run hypervisors inside hypervisors inside hypervisors?
There are some papers that they asked their question and reached, I think, 6 layers. But yeah, I think that more than 2 are already a lot of, in terms of performance. You are really doing this context switching between the different privileges of the operating system, different VMs that you have. Not that useful, I think.
And your doctoral thesis was in the multi-cloud space.
I was working for a company that was really interested in seeing if we can break a bit the vendor lock-ins that we have in cloud providers and try to define an abstract infrastructure, so we can define how many VMs, our topology, virtual network, and so on. And then there is a kind of a language that allows us to compile it on the cloud providers that we prefer. It's something that at a certain point has been achieved with Kubernetes today, because you can own a Kubernetes cluster on any provider. But at the time, there was a huge focus on infrastructure as code. And so the idea was to define this meta language that was then compiled in the proprietary language of the cloud provider and then deployed. So it was this kind of compiler that I realized during the PhD was my main result.
A lot of people who try and build a system like this, especially in the early days of infrastructure as a service, end up building a lowest common denominator system where they are only able to implement things that exist on all of their target platforms. How did you deal with that problem in your research?
The idea was to have an abstract definition and then have multiple implementation. Mm-hmm. We have an intelligence saying, okay, I have 3 providers implementing this kind of service, and then I can always do a custom. So I don't know, I have a VPN as a service on one provider, and then I have the possibility, the specification of an infrastructure that builds a VM, installs the VPN service that I want, and deploys it. So the idea was to say, okay, if I don't have the manager service, I will fall back on the custom one, on the least common denominator, but at least I try to describe my infrastructure in an abstract way, and so the manager service could be taken consideration, because the problem was that you are normally building your infrastructure for a specific cloud provider, and if the cloud provider has not that service, you are not really trying to use a manager service for that.
We talked about this a little bit when we're talking to Daniel from Crossplane, and maybe talking about the idea of if you have a managed service on a cloud provider and you're running somewhere that doesn't have that service, you may have to deploy something. So they may have a load balancer that exists, but you may have to run Nginx or HAProxy or something on an environment that doesn't have that as a service.
It was really a nice project because it also uses the abstraction of Kubernetes, so the APIs of Kubernetes, and this word that is quite popular today and is available on all clusters, on all cloud providers. It's a really good project, and I thought really fantastic to have a lot more of work, but see, they have the same idea implemented and seeing a lot of people enthusiastic about that was really nice.
After spending a few years in Paris, you've moved back to Turin. And we spoke to Gianluca in episode 142, and he pointed out that Turin is basically Cloud City in Italy.
We are known as a car city because there were a lot of factories that produced cars back in the last century. Mm-hmm. Now I think that we are in the breaking point where there are more and more companies working with IT and cloud. We have also plenty of students that are really interested in cloud technologies that came to Turin to study them. We have courses about it. So I think that maybe it's a wishful thinking, but I really think that Turin is becoming, in a sense, a cloud city or a city where the cloud computing companies are present and they want to invest.
Which car companies were based in Turin?
It was Fiat. Now it is Stellantis. Before the 80s, there were 2 or 3 smaller, but then the market consolidated quite a lot. So Fiat owns all the other ones.
Tell me about the research group that you work in now.
I'm working in the Darwin department at Polytechnic. So this is a department of computer science mainly. And inside that, we are in a research group called NET Group. The historical focus of NET Group is on computer networks, in particular network processing. There are a lot of work and also open source project that work around the eBPF world recently. So for example, Polycube that was initiated there. Now, there is also a shift on more cloud-native technologies, so Kubernetes. There are also cloud computing courses at Polytechnic that is done by our group. We also started another project, a side LICO called Clown Labs, mm-hmm. that is made by students and it tries to provide a laboratory platform for students during the pandemic. So the idea is that people can do their lab, even if they are not at Polytechnic, and they are using VMs on Kubernetes, using KubeVirt. No VNC to connect to them. So it's a simple platform, but it's completely built by students. It's also operated by students. So it's kind of interesting for them to see which are the jobs that you can do around the cluster. So the one you operate and maintain it, the one build application in a Kubernetes native way.
Is that using nested virtualization?
No, I don't think so. We use a bare metal cluster. Mm-hmm. It was challenging because at the beginning, it was kind of a bet that we made. We have all the ingredients. So we have a Rook, we have MetalLB, the open source project that cover what we have to do. So it's quite also fast.
I love how we have the confluence of eBPF and bare metal all coming together in Turin again.
I've not really worked a lot on eBPF, so I cannot discuss it a lot. I know that they published some important papers during last years. On bare metal, so in the NET group, we have the passion of working with the real solid PC, the solid server, so to connect cables. This is something that we really love. And even if it's not mandatory today, we ask the professor to buy us servers to play with. And we are playing, but we are also achieving some interesting results. So,
are you teaching yourself?
I'm doing more the practical part to students. So there are those labs around Kubernetes, cloud computing, so virtual machines, containers, Ansible, and all the main technologies that we have today.
How do you balance the academic side of things and research on this platform versus the fact that this is obviously a marketable skill and that people want to learn things that they can then use when they go out into the real world?
There is the lab part where we have to build, to write code and to make people learn how they can use cloud technologies. But there is also the fact that in academics, if you do not build interesting projects in terms of engineering, it's hard to have an impact with your research. So, for example, you can run your algorithm, you can put your intelligence, things that are really appreciated in papers, but you have not the underlying layers to make good experimentation to show that your idea is really valid and worth to be published in good venues. So I think that the balance is that what we try to do is to have a huge work on engineering as a basis to show that our algorithm, our ideas are interesting.
On the LICO homepage, you say that the project started because you had plenty of powerful computers in your labs, but there were always some students complaining about their laptops not being powerful enough to run their jobs. That sounds to me like a quote that could have come out in the year 2000 when I was at university. We had tools like distcc for compiling. There's things like SETI at home where you can run workloads that are effectively modern big data workloads. And now, of course, we have the whole Hadoop ecosystem. What kind of jobs were your students looking to run, and why did you build something new versus using one of those existing technologies?
The idea was really to let them run, for example, desktop applications inside using their resources, but also the resources that we have at Polytechnic. So, for example, we have this course in graphics, and they use a lot of Blender, and they have to render a lot of projects, and they struggle using their laptop. Mm-hmm. And also, the solution provided with virtualization are not powerful enough to cope with it. We would like to have something that it is quite generic, and it also can work with containers and modern technologies and modern way to package applications.
You mentioned Blender there. Do 3D rendering packages like Blender have support for multiple backends? And if so, is that support built on top of containers today?
I've not really directly worked on this project. I know that in the Clown Labs project, there is undergoing work. From the test I saw, they are able to run the Blender worker, and they have a master Blender, and the work is split among those workers. And they can tweak the amount of resources they consume with resource and request on limits on Kubernetes. We also did a test using a 3D card GPU.
Mm-hmm.
It worked well. You had to configure a bit more what you are doing. So you have to use Docker with the GPU support, but it worked pretty fine.
We mentioned a problem that the Polytechnic has in terms of resource sharing. Can you talk a little bit now about Leeco, which is your solution to that problem, and what it does?
The idea of Leeco starts from the fact that we have a lot of clusters today. The idea is that Kubernetes, as we were saying before, is the common denominator of the infrastructure. The scenario that we have is that we have a lot of clusters almost everywhere. Sometimes it's useful to see them as a unique cluster and so have the possibility to optimize the pod placement and the application placement and the application flows also in presence of a decentralized governance. So the fact that some resources can belong to the partner of one organization and other resources may belong to another organization. The idea is really to create a way to peer, as we mentioned in the website, the cluster in order to create multi-cluster topologies to fulfill different tasks, for example, hybrid cloud bursting or disaster recovery and so on.
In the case where you have one owner or one university, in your case, who operate all the machines, you might just think that they should all be joined to one cluster. Why are they not?
For example, in Politecnico, we have several clusters that belong to different departments. So we have the computer science department, the electronic department, the IT department, and they are okay to say, when we are not using our resources, you can use them, but would prefer if you are not admin on our resources, or if you want to have a limited amount of resources on our cluster. And on the other end, for our user, we would not have to say, okay, now you have to use that cluster, and so you have to change your kubeconfig, change your configuration, and so on. So
right.
What we would like to have is a transparent expansion of our clusters. This is the situation that we would like to model. There are also other points that you may know is that, for example, from the network perspective, the Kubernetes scheduler does not take into account the latency. So if you have nodes that are far away, they will be considered near, and so you can have strange behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Those were more or less the reason why we thought about Leeco in this way.
What then is the process of joining these clusters together? You have a host cluster, and then you somehow need to teach it about the existence of other clusters and give it credentials to operate upon them?
The first problem that we thought to solve is about discovery. For example, we have a cluster, and in an organization, we may want to know which are the other clusters available. And this is something that Leeco is able to handle using DNS, so records like we used in the SIP protocol, or we implemented another approach based on MDNS. For example, if I have two Raspberry Pis that are in the same network with Leeco installed, they can discover each other and read across them. This is the first point.
Right.
When we have discovered, we have this protocol that establishes the administrative peer. So the idea is that one cluster says, I would like to know if you have resources that you can provide me, and the other say, okay, you receive a resource offer, and it says, okay, I can provide you those resources, and if you are interested in, you will accept and create the peering. This peering will have two effects. The first one is to create a virtual node using a virtual kubelet. So we implemented the provider for Kubernetes starting from the Microsoft project, which I think is now a CNCF project, virtual kubelet.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates also an overlay network that allow you to have pods communicating on the two clusters. So from cluster A to cluster B, for example, transparently.
You mentioned there MDNS networking, or Bonjour, as they call it in the Apple world, the idea of these things being able to just discover themselves. Is there an implication that if you're on the same LAN, then you are part of the same trust domain and these things can just join? Or is there some sort of process where the administrators have to publish out they're willing to share?
You can activate, enable, or disable the sharing, but if you want to enable, we consider the LAN as a trust domain,
mm-hmm.
but you also can enable kind of a token that you have to provide offline to make the other cluster capable of peering with you. So the idea is that it's like more or less the Bootstrap TLS. It's a lot simpler and not as secure, but the idea behind is the same.
If the clusters trust each other by virtue of being on the same LAN, is there some form of identity on top of that? If I have user accounts on the first cluster, do they somehow replicate through to the subsequent clusters?
We have a cluster identity. So far, we've not focused on the users inside the cluster. So the identity are per cluster. Mm-hmm. And they are expected to have a unique cluster ID. And this cluster ID is exchanged with the other one. So I know that there is that cluster and that cluster is not another one. So for example, there cannot be conflict on this part. There are many implications for security, so we are working on that. So in this peer-to-peer world, it's hard to establish who is who. Mm-hmm. So what we are trying to avoid is that something is trying to fake its identity to become another ID that it discovered somehow else. So this is what we are hiding in 0.3 version, which is the next version of Lico. But what we think we should do in next releases is also to be capable to rely on third-party services that can provide you an identity which is trusted.
You've talked about how these clusters are peers to each other. And if we think about how peering works in an internet network sense, we use the BGP protocol, which again is famous for sort of being very open in terms of trust and only recently has had to have identity put on top of that. When you have these networks that you connect together, they may well have the same network address space. So you'll need to do some sort of translation between them. How does the overlay system deal with translation between networks?
This was one of the design principles that we thought at the beginning. So the idea is that those two clusters may not know anything from each other. So they have been created in different times and they have different CNIs, for example, but also they may have conflicting pod ciders. So what we implemented in the Nitro networking is a double NATCH mechanism that allows you to talk to another pod on the other cluster using a NATCH IP. Obviously, we will not discover this pod. You can discover it manually, but also the interesting part is that this translation is inserted in what we call the service replication. So the fact that the endpoints of a cluster are replicated on the other one in order to make those endpoints discoverable on the second cluster, and so make services available also on the cluster that is on the other side.
This sounds like a problem that IPv6 was designed to fix, albeit maybe designed 25 years ago. When Kubernetes supports IPv6, do you think that some of that complexity can go away?
Maybe. So far, we have made the assumption that IPv6 is kind of not adopted a lot, and so we will stick to IPv4. IPv4 has also another important concern about the scalability of this model. So if we think of peering multiple clusters, you easily may finish your private IP. So what do you do? For that, we think that IPv6 may be a solution, but we would see a bit more adoption by community and system administrators, because it seemed to me always that IPv6 scares people. I personally love it, so I don't understand why, but yeah.
I moved to London just over 12 years ago, and one of the first things that I did was went to an Internet Society event that Vint Cerf had come over to present at, and he said, IPv6 is just around the corner and you'll have it tomorrow, and gave me some stickers and so on, and we're still waiting.
I remember when I was a student and the professor said, yeah, IPv6 is there, but his slide was dated, I don't know, the 90s, so will be really tomorrow or we have to wait for a few more years, but yeah.
Is there a lot of Linux on the desktop in your research group?
All of the people working on Lico have Linux on their desktop.
Well, there you go. If it's the year of Linux on the desktop, then we can't have IPv6 yet. You mentioned they're running a service with pods on different clusters. I was going to ask, is this used for hosting or real-time work, or is it predominantly used for batch jobs, things like the Blender workloads you talked about before?
We did a demo with Google microservice application. So the idea is that we have this private cluster with a lot of microservices that at a certain point runs out of resources, and the pods are moved on a remote cluster on the cloud. And the idea is that services should continue to work and requests have to be balanced across different endpoints. The idea is that it has to be suitable also for real application and the reflection of endpoints. We started doing it with normal endpoints resources, which is very complex because you have only one resource for service, but with endpoint slices, you may have multiple resources to provide endpoints for the same service. And so it became easier to do that and faster also.
How does your virtual kubelet node know what the state of these clusters are? Is it only when it's done its discovery, or if things change in the remote clusters, are they kept up to date?
We basically watch pods and we schedule on the remote cluster. And when there is a change, the change is reflected on the local cluster.
And how does that reflection process work? Is that an agent that's running in the remote cluster that has permission to call back into the API server of the host?
It's the virtual kubelet that has informers connected to the remote API server, agentless in a sense on the remote cluster, The reason we adopt that is that we want to keep as low as possible the consumed resource on the remote cluster. So we just want to consume resources when we deployed something. So we have those kind of routines that watches the object and update them locally. This is done for pods we scheduled, for config maps and services and other objects. The point of having a virtual kubelet was that we create this virtual node, which is completely transparent for the control plane of Kubernetes, so the Kubernetes control plane. It works smoothly with the basic Kubernetes scheduler, so we have not changed a bit of it. And we also can have this dynamic placement of pods in the cluster because it sees it as an extra node of its cluster, so it simply attaches pod to them.
Does this qualify as federation? What have you learned from previous attempts than Kubernetes that have used that scary word?
So I think that you can create some sort of federation if you think, for example, to have one cluster that is paired with plenty of other ones, and this is the center of your star, for example. You can create a topology like that, but it's not mandatory. When we started looking at the federation of time that we had in Kubernetes, for example, KubeFed, what we found a bit difficult to adopt is the fact that they ask you to change the way your workload were defined. So you have this federated deployment, which were really, really expressive, but you have to say your user changing the way you are doing your work, and it's not really easy to do sometimes. On the other hand, the virtual kubelet approach allows you to spread your pods in a more dynamic way, I would say. So you have not to say, okay, this is deployment for cluster A and the deployment for cluster B, but you have a deployment, and then it goes on cluster A and goes on cluster B dynamically and transparently.
We've talked about how this works in effectively a single trust domain, being the LAN of your university. Do you see applications for Leeko in commercial multi-tenant situations?
For the moment, we thought about a single organization because Leeko does not provide any isolation in terms of tenants. So it's our roadmap to use a third-party project to have this isolation and to protect a bit the cluster. Hopefully, we will reach a level of isolation where this can be interesting. So we can say, okay, I rented a part of my cluster to someone else. For the moment, I think we are not mature enough for a scenario like that, but maybe possible, actually.
Another thing on your roadmap is support for Amazon's Elastic Kubernetes Service. You currently support GKE and Microsoft's AKS. What is it that needs to change for supporting extra providers? What is it above standard vanilla Kubernetes that needs to be used here?
The main problem is related to network. So every provider has his way to implement Kubernetes networking. This is true also for on-premise clusters. So you can have multiple CNIs, which have many, many different behaviors. AKS, so we have a different behavior from GKE and AKS. So we have to deal with it. Mm-hmm. Requires us a bit more work. You have also slight differences concerning the control plane, which is something that is provided as a service in managed clusters. For example, the CSR API is slightly different, so it does not allow you to have certain certificate. Mm-hmm. For example, if you want to use a virtual kubelet with logs and exec commands, you have to let your API server to connect to the virtual kubelet, but you have to have a specific certificate. Some providers don't let provide to have this kind of certificate. So it's ongoing, but yeah, a bit more complex than the other two.
And what other things are on your roadmap? Are they defined by the Polytechnics use case, or are they from now external community requests?
We are building an external community to feed our roadmap. This is the idea. So for the moment, we had more internal use cases because they were the only one that we have. So we have one meeting on Monday, 6:30 Central Europe time, so 18:30. We try to talk with other people, with organization, ask for new interesting problem to solve that can be solved with Leeko. So yeah, we are a bit opening. So now with 0.2, we show that the Leeko approach works. Mm-hmm. So we would like now to make it work for more use cases and find who is interested in this technology.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Alex.
Thank you very much.
You can find Alex on Twitter at PAlexster. How do you pronounce that?
In Italian, it was Palexer. And the reason why I choose this is because my usual nickname at the time was already taken on Gmail, so it proposed me Palex, and I like it.
Brilliant. And you can find Leeko at liqo.io. Patrick, thank you very much for helping us out with the show today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
If you've enjoyed the show, please help us spread the word and tell a friend. If you have any feedback for us, you can find us on Twitter at KubernetesPod or reach us by email at KubernetesPodcast@google.com.
You can also check out the website at KubernetesPodcast.com, where you will find transcripts and show notes, as well as links to subscribe.
I'll be back and at KubeCon next week, so tap me on the shoulder if you see me. Until then, thanks for listening.